From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
109th Congress is the laziest Congress of all time. I mean, they didn't just break the record for fewest days work, they crushed it by about a month.
The worst Congress ever? Rolling Stone contributing editor Matt Taibbi takes a look at the 109th Congress. Then the New Jersey Supreme Court rules gay couples are entitled to the same legal rights as married heterosexuals. We'll speak with one of the seven gay couples who filed suit. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Amidst rising criticism from Republican ranks and a deepening split with Iraqi leaders, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld has issued a new message to critics of the Iraq war. Back off. At a Pentagon briefing Thursday, Rumsfeld told reporters, quote, "This is complicated stuff. It's difficult. We're looking out into the future. No one can predict the future with absolute certainty. So you ought to just back off, take a look at it, relax, and understand that it's complicated, but it will get worked out," he said. Rumsfeld's comments come as increasing numbers of Republicans are calling for his dismissal. On Wednesday, Republican Senator Olympia Snowe of Maine said President Bush should have accepted Rumsfeld's resignation when it was first offered. Republican Senator Mike DeWine of Ohio and Congressmember Ann Northup of Kentucky also called for Rumsfeld's replacement this week. Northup said, quote, "You cannot afford to lose the numbers we're losing now and just keep slugging away." A U.S. Marine has pleaded guilty to assault and conspiracy in the killing of an unarmed Iraqi in the town of Hamdaniya. The Marine Private First Class John Jotka is the youngest and lowest ranked of the seven charged for the murder of Hashim Ibrahim Awad. The Marines shot Awad after pulling him from his home last April. They initially tried to cover up the slaying by placing a rifle at the scene to give the appearance Awad was an insurgent. In other Iraq news, a senior UN official is warning Iraqi women are facing increasing violence for speaking out. Appearing before the UN Security Council Thursday, UN Development Fund for Women Executive Director Noeline Hazer said women are becoming assassination targets when they affirm women's rights in public decision-making. Hazer also warned of a similar plight for women in Afghanistan and Somalia. Meanwhile, former Chief UN Weapons Inspector Hans Blix has issued some of his harshest criticism to date of the Iraq war. In an interview with a Danish newspaper this week, Blix called the war, quote, "a pure failure." Blix says, although Saddam Hussein would still be in power had the U.S. not invaded, quote, "what we've gotten is undoubtedly worse," he said. New details have emerged in the killings of dozens of Afghan civilians by a NATO airstrike earlier this week. Local leaders say the attack occurred in the village of Panjwai. Residents were celebrating the end of the month-long holiday fast of Ramadan. Between 50 to 85 people were slain, most of them women and children. Dozens more were wounded and several homes destroyed in over 4 hours of continuous bombing. At least 20 people were buried in a mass grave. Abdul Ai, a resident of the near my village, said, quote, "everyone's angry at the government and the coalition. There was no Taliban. These tragedies just keep continuing," he said. In other news, the German military says six people are under investigation over published photographs showing German soldiers desecrating a human skull in Afghanistan. The skull was reportedly taken from a mass grave at least 2 years ago. Four of the six under investigation are longer in the military. The publication of the photographs has sparked outrage in Afghanistan. This is Afghan government spokesperson Sultan Ahmad Bahin.
The government and the people of Afghanistan have been saddened by the news of desecration of human skull by German soldiers in Afghanistan. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Islamic Republic of Afghanistan strongly condemns this action, which goes against Islamic values and Afghan traditions.
In Colombia, the Bush administration has pledged to renew an annual $600 million in military assistance to President Alvaro Uribe. The funding expired last year with the end of the $4 billion Plan Colombia program enacted under the Clinton administration. U.S. Undersecretary of State Nicholas Burns made the announcement in Bogota.
Well, I think, first of all, we want to see a continuation of Plan Colombia, and we're here to discuss with President Uribe and his cabinet how that might be possible, what their own ideas are. We think that the counterterrorism and counter-narcotics efforts have been very successful, but there can be further progress, I think.
U.S. assistance for Colombia has come under criticism from human rights groups who've accused the government-backed paramilitary forces of committing the bulk of atrocities there. U.S. aid has also helped fund a reconciliation plan that's granted amnesty to scores of militants accused of massacres and abuse. At the U.N., a meeting between the foreign ministers of Venezuela and Guatemala has failed to resolve the impasse in their race for an open seat on the U.N. Security Council. Both sides say they'll withdraw their candidacy if they can compromise on a replacement. In an interview with the Reuters news agency Thursday, Venezuelan Foreign Minister Nicolas Maduro said Venezuela would rather lose outright than drop out of the race under pressure from the U.S.
Por primera vez en 16 años de mundo...
For the first time in 16 years since the unipolar world started, the United States has clearly demonstrated that they have a fatal obsession against Venezuela. They want to prevent Venezuela from becoming a member of the Security Council.
Maduro went on to say his government has the support of 80% of Latin American and Caribbean countries at the United Nations. Here in the United States, President Bush has signed legislation to build new walling on the border with Mexico. The 700-mile-long barrier would run along parts of California, Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas. The president held a signing ceremony Thursday at the White House.
Ours is a nation of immigrants. We're also a nation of law. Unfortunately, the United States has not been in complete control of its borders for decades. And therefore, illegal immigration has been on the rise. We have a responsibility to address these challenges. We have a responsibility to enforce our laws. We have a responsibility to secure our borders. We take this responsibility seriously.
Critics are accusing the Bush administration of using the signing ceremony as a political tool to motivate support among anti-immigrant voters. The president already approved $1.2 billion in spending for the wall in a bill signed earlier this month. And limits imposed by Congress call into question whether the money will go towards a physical barrier. Meanwhile, the wall continues to meet vigorous opposition in Mexico. On Thursday, hundreds of demonstrators gathered outside the U.S. Embassy in Mexico City. This is one of the protesters.
We reject the wall because it is a total cancellation of the human rights of the Mexican people, and mainly because we know that the economy of the United States is supported by the efforts of the workers.
Mexican President-elect Felipe Calderón also repeated his government's opposition to the barrier. He spoke Thursday during a visit to Canada.
I would like to repeat that it seems to us a deplorable decision that the United States Congress and the government has made to go ahead and build a wall along the border. Walls do not resolve anything. Humanity made a grave error when a wall was built in Berlin, and I am certain that today the United States has made a grave error in making the decision to construct a wall.
In political news, new polling numbers show a widening lead for Democrats ahead of next month's midterm elections. According to Zogby International, 44% of Americans say they'll vote for Democratic candidates. 33% say they'll vote Republican. Meanwhile, Republican support is dropping among its key base of evangelical Christians. According to the Pew Research Center, 57% of white evangelicals say they'll likely vote Republican this year, a 21-point drop from 2 years ago. As Republican numbers continue to slide, one of the party's leading figures is urging candidates to take voters' focus off the Iraq War. In an interview with the Concord Monitor Tuesday, retiring Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist said, quote, "The challenge is to get Americans to focus on pocketbook issues and not on the Iraq and terror issue." In other election news, Republicans have pulled a Tennessee campaign ad widely criticized for being racially divisive. The 30-second television spot features fictional characters satirizing Democratic Congressmember Harold Ford. Ford is an African-American. He's running for the Senate seat vacated by Majority Leader Bill Frist. Republican National Committee Chair Ken Mellman announced the withdrawal of the advertisement on Thursday. Just days earlier, Mellman insisted he had no authority to take the spot off the air because of campaign finance laws. This news from Guantanamo Bay. The Boston Globe is reporting the Bush administration is renewing a push to impose severe restrictions on how prisoners communicate with their attorneys. The administration wants new rules that would restrict attorney visits, limit mail communication, and control what topics attorneys and prisoners can discuss. The government also wants the military to exert authority over restricting communication rather than leaving it to the courts. In Los Angeles, immigration officials have arrested a former Salvadoran Army officer convicted in the 1989 murders of six Jesuit priests, their housekeeper and her daughter. The convict, Gonzalo Guevara Cerritos, illegally entered the U.S. last year. He'll be deported back to El Salvador. In business news, ExxonMobil has posted another record-setting profit. The oil giant made a third-quarter profit of $10.49 billion. The earnings mark the second-highest total of any publicly traded company in U.S. history, second only to Exxon's own final quarter last year. Some of the nation's leading retailers and clothing brands are being accused of using an abuse-laden factory that employs child labor in Bangladesh. The National Labor Committee says around 200 children are sewing clothing for Hanes, Walmart, JCPenney, and Puma at the factory. Some of the children are younger than 11 years old. The youths told investigators they face routine beatings and work days that extend through the night. Some say they've been paid as little as 6 cents an hour. Charlie Kurgan-Turnigan, the director of the National Labor Committee, said, quote, "Children belong in school, not locked in sweatshops. Walmart, Hanes, and the other companies owe these children," he said. In media news, owners of the radio giant Clear Channel Communications are in talks to take the company private. The company could fetch up to $18.5 billion from a group of investors. Clear Channel currently owns more than 1,200 radio stations across the country and could own more pending media ownership proposals currently before the FCC. And finally, the private mercenary company Blackwater has hired former independent counsel and Whitewater investigator Kenneth Starr in its defense against a wrongful death lawsuit brought by families of four employees killed in Iraq. The news is revealed in a new piece in the Nation website by Democracy Now! Correspondent and Nation fellow Jeremy Scahill, entitled From Whitewater to Blackwater. The families are suing Blackwater for wrongful death over its alleged failure to provide adequate protection to contractors killed in the Iraqi city of Fallujah in March of 2004. Kenneth Starr has played a prominent role in Blackwater's attempts to have the case dismissed or moved to federal court, where it would have a higher likelihood of being heard by Republican appointees. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. With just over a week left to Election Day, the mainstream media is focusing on key contested issues that are shaping this year's midterm elections. Control of the House and Senate is up for grabs in what many describe as the most pivotal battle for Congress in over a decade.
Whatever the outcome, the 110th U.S. Congress will open session on January 3, 2007. While the country's attention remains focused on the upcoming elections, few are considering the current state of the legislative branch. How did the 109th Congress perform? Well, the cover story of this week's Rolling Stone magazine takes on that issue. The article is called The Worst Congress Ever: How Our National Legislature Has Become a Stable of Thieves and Perverts in Five Easy Steps. It's written by Matt Taibbi, a contributing editor for the magazine. He joins us now in studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Matt.
Thanks for having me.
Why worst?
Well, there's so many reasons why this is the worst. The easiest ones to talk about statistically, it's just the mere laziness factor. You've heard of the famous Do-Nothing Congress from 1948. This Congress smashed the record that was set by that Congress for fewest days ever worked by a Congress. That Congress worked a total of 249 days between the House and the Senate. This Congress worked 218 days total. So they beat that record by a month. And even those 218 days were made up a lot of fragmentary days. So the House, for instance, had 9 days that were less than 11 minutes long, and the Senate had 3 days less than 1 minute. So this is easily the laziest Congress of all time, if nothing else.
But when they are in session, they've done quite a bit to change the way the Congress operates, right? I mean, what about the rules changes that you talk about in your article?
Well, there's been a lot of changes just in the way that bills get heard, bills get talked about. One of the things that this Congress has done is drastically reduce the number of what's called open rules. And open rules are bills that make it to the House floor in a form that allows congressmen to debate them and offer amendments to them. There was a time back in the late 70s when about 75% of the bills that made it to the floor were open rules. Now, it should be said that that number continued to decline while the Democrats still controlled Congress. By the time the Democrats ceded control in 94, that number was about 30%. This year, there were no open rules except for appropriations bills, which are always open. So we've basically seen the last of those kinds of openly debated bills in Congress.
Rule by cabal, what do you mean?
Well, the Republicans have basically figured out a way to totally exclude the minority from the process. You know, obviously, if you have the majority in Congress, you're going to have most of the influence anyway. But traditionally, in Congress, there's been a power-sharing agreement. Bills were usually made up in session between the minority and the majority, and the two parties always work together to make up major legislation. That's done now in Congress. That doesn't happen anymore. A great example is that conference committees, where when you have the conference that hammers out the differences between the Senate and the House versions of bills, traditionally, both parties work in that conference committee to create the final version of the bill. Well, this Congress has sort of pioneered a new method of handling the conferences. What they'll do is they'll have, by law, they have to have one conference that includes Democrats. They'll have a five-minute meeting where the Democrats are there. They'll take a picture, and then they'll kick the Democrats out, and they'll hold the real meeting later, and they won't tell the Democrats where it is. And you get this situation that results, it's really like a, you know, an elementary school thing where they won't tell the Democrats where it is, so the Democratic minority member will have to go around Congress literally searching for the conference, knocking on doors saying, "Are you inside?"
Give us an example.
There was a famous example where the Ways and Means Committee, chaired by Bill Thomas, a congressman from California, he didn't tell the ranking minority member, who was Charlie Rangel here from New York, he didn't tell him where the conference was. And Rangel went around the Congress looking for this conference, knocking on doors, and he finally finds it. He knocks on the door, and the Republicans hid behind the door, pretending that they weren't inside. Literally, like little kids, they hid it. They hid in there. You know, the one congressional aide said it was like the old SNL skit Land Shark, where Charlie Rangel was the land shark. The Republicans wouldn't open the door. They finally opened it, and Thomas says to Rangel, he says, "Sorry, this is only for the coalition of the willing." And he basically kicked Rangel out of the room. Actually, I'm sorry, they packed up their stuff and they left and they held the conference someplace else. And this kind of stuff happens at every level, at every stage of the congressional process now. So everywhere where you used to have meetings between the two parties where they would work things out, the Republicans just disallow participation by the Democrats.
In your article, you paint a portrait of many of these congressional staffers that are just sort of lost now, the Democratic staffers, with nothing to do, and they haven't seen the sun in 7 years, you say, yeah. Some of them. And what's the impact on the Democrats of this kind of total, not just embarrassment, but
humiliation?
Humiliation, yes.
Yeah. It's completely changed the way that Congress does business, and this is something that's difficult to quantify, but again, Congress used to be a collegial place. It used to be a place where Democrats and Republicans, they may be differed ideologically, but they used to hang out together on the weekends. They used to play golf, you know, together on the weekends, and that was where a lot of things got worked out socially. Was, you know, outside of Congress, they would have lunch together. They would socialize together with their wives. That doesn't happen anymore, and there's a complete antipathy now between the parties, to a degree that the new generation, even of Democrats, doesn't even understand the theory of communicating with the Republicans about things. Rangel, this congressman from New York, tells a great story about how, I guess it was last year, he went up to go talk to Clay Shaw, who was a Republican from Florida, and he had heard Shaw was sick, and he wanted to go and sit, you know, pay his respects to him, and he goes and says hello to Shaw on the other end of the floor, And when Rangel gets back, one of the young Democrats leans over to him and he goes, "What the hell was that about?" You know, in other words, the young Democrats don't even understand why you would talk to a Republican, even socially. And this is, you know, so you have the new generation of congressmen that doesn't even know how to work together.
Matt Taibbi, what happened when the Democrats wanted to have a hearing on the Patriot Act?
Well, again, this is another way that they exclude Democrats from the process. Typically, congressmen are allowed to hold hearings. Even the minority members of a committee are allowed to hold hearings whenever you want to. But the Republican chairmen have decided to make it as difficult as possible for Democrats to do this. So in this instance, the Democrats wanted to hold a meeting on the Patriot Act in the Judiciary Committee. So they asked James Sensenbrenner, who is the chairman. He's this famously dictatorial congressman from Wisconsin. And he said, yeah, sometime in the future, but he didn't tell them when. Then one Thursday night, late in Thursday night, he says, okay, you're on for tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. So the Democrats have to scramble all their witnesses, get everything prepared overnight. But they do. They get everything done, and by 9 o'clock the next morning, they're ready to hold their hearing. Well, they start having their hearing, and Sensenbrenner decides that he's bored and he wants to leave, and he tries to gavel the hearing to a close before everyone's done. The Democrats said, no, we're not finished. So Sensenbrenner, that wasn't good enough for him. So he literally got up, walked across the room, shut the lights off, shut the microphones off, and closed the door behind him, leaving the Democrats with all their witnesses, which included people from groups like Amnesty International and other groups, just sitting there in the dark. You know, again, this is stuff that you would expect in an elementary school, you know, not in the Congress. I used to live in Russia. Even the Duma wasn't this bad, you know. So.
And the impact of this, first of all, in terms of how much of the American people know about these operations and how they've been going now for the past few years, and the impact on the legislation that comes out.
Well, I think the American people just don't have any idea of what congressional procedure is like. If they knew the way that laws were made or not made in most cases, I think, you know, you might have people storming the Bastille. You know, what's happened in Congress now is that the process is completely corrupted. In other words, almost everything is a backroom deal now. There are no open debates, no open hearings. Anything you see on C-SPAN is all for show because the important decisions are all made in backrooms, in committee. And what happens in these committee hearings behind the scenes is that, you know, the public sees one bill, but then the night before the bill goes to be voted on, the Republicans who actually make the decisions gather together and they take a bill that's about this thick and they make it about this thick. And what they
much thicker.
Right, yeah. And what they're doing is they're shoving earmarks in there. And what earmarks are, for people who don't know, are little tiny provisions in a bill that are usually favors of some kind, projects, you know, highway bills, you know, new public works projects, and it's basically a gift to the congressman's district. And we've seen an explosion of these earmarks over the years. Take the energy bill in the Clinton years, the last energy bill had 6,000 earmarks in it. In the Bush years, it had 15,000. So you know, these are things that are never voted on in committee, that you never see debated. And it's all done behind the scenes. It's not it's not democracy anymore. It's basically like an authoritarian system.
You mentioned laziness before. What about laziness in the appropriations bills? How does that work?
Well, this Congress has failed to pass. There are 11 appropriations bills every year. This Congress has failed to pass more than 3 on time in any year since Bush has been elected. Which doesn't sound like that big a deal, because when you don't pass your appropriations bill, you just pass a continuing resolution and everything gets funded anyway. There are two problems with that. When you don't pass appropriations bills on time, what ends up happening is that they end up dumping everything from all the remaining unpassed appropriations bills into one giant omnibus bill that gets passed usually in the last 2 days of the congressional year. So you have these congressmen who haven't passed the appropriations bill. So they show up, they're 2 days away from their Christmas vacation, and then they get literally an 8,000-page bill lands in their desk, you know, on the last working day of the year. And nobody knows what's in these bills. Nobody. Not even, in most cases, the people who wrote them don't even know. And you find the most, so the staffers have to go through these bills and race through them to make sure there isn't some egregious violation in there. One staffer told me a story of an amazing thing that he discovered in an omnibus bill just before it was about to be passed. It was a provision that would have allowed the Appropriations Committee to look at the private information of any taxpayer in this country, the private tax return information, which is supposed to be only for the eyes of the IRS. But they were going to put a provision in that made it possible for just the members of the Appropriations Committee to see that information. And, you know, it was just something that was buried in this giant bill. And this is the kind of stuff that happens when you don't pass things on time.
And in terms of the prospects now, if there is a change in this Congress, do you expect that some of the processes that have now taken hold will continue even if there's a Democratic majority?
Well, there's a real fear in Congress that a lot of these new processes are not going to change if the Democrats take control of the Congress. And the Democrats themselves are worried about that because they don't know. You know, things have changed since 1994 when the Democrats last controlled the Congress. There's so much more money involved in the process now. There's so many more campaign contributors, and they've figured out so many new ways to get to the congressman, you know, like with these golf junkets that you hear about with Jack Abramoff and that kind of thing, lobbyists writing legislation, you know, for the congressman. You know, all of this stuff has come as a result of an explosion of money that's come into the Congress in the last decade or so. And the Democrats, frankly, are worried because they don't know how their own members are going to react to it. So this is going to be something that's going to be interesting to watch when the Democrats, if they do take control. Also, it's not known whether they're going to want to exact revenge on the Republicans and exclude them to the degree that the Republicans excluded them in the last 6 years or so.
What about Congress being a check and balance on the executive branch, on the president, how it has changed?
Yeah, not anymore. This is probably the most disgusting thing about this Congress, if you can imagine that there's a most disgusting thing. But the Congress under in the Clinton years, which was mostly the same Republican Congress, they issued over 1,000 subpoenas to the Clinton administration during Clinton's time in office. Since Bush has come into office, they haven't issued a single subpoena to the Bush White House. Now, they have issued a few to the Bush administration, but not to the White House. And you know, this is a time period where we've seen some extraordinary things happen that should have been investigated, you know, from the misuse of intelligence to get us into Iraq to, you know, failure to act appropriately before 9/11 to Katrina to all these things to the Valerie Plame incident. These are all things that would have been investigated in the past. And they're not being investigated now. And what you have as a result of that is a body that's bureaucratically castrated. They just no longer have any will or any ability to stand up to the executive branch for any reason. And this is a dangerous situation for this country. You know, the Congress exists to act as a check on the power of the executive branch, and they're not doing it anymore.
Do you see in this next two years that changing? I mean, if the Democrats were to take over, would you see this spate of investigations and money poured into it?
I think you probably will. I think the Democrats, if they get control of the, especially if they get control of both houses, I think you're going to see a lot of investigation into some of the activities of the Bush White House. But unfortunately, that's not the best test of how the Congress is going to operate. I think if it was the Democratic president and the Democrats were in control, we need to see that they would investigate their own.
And what about all these corruption scandals that have erupted in the last? A couple of years. What's been the impact of that on business as usual there?
Well, again, that's a terrible thing. And, you know, there have only been a few indictments, you know, related to the Jack Abramoff incident. But we know that at least 12 congressmen did, Republican congressmen did favors for Jack Abramoff, who wrote letters for him or got things introduced into the congressional record. And that's probably just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, the amount of money that goes into congressional fundraising. I think there was $13 million donated to congressional campaigns last year. That includes both parties. When you consider that there was an incident, for instance, when a company called Westar wanted to get a provision put into the energy bill, and internal company documents were released, emails saying that they had been told by Republican leaders that they needed to donate $58,000 to the Congress to get this provision passed. When you consider that $58,000 is the cost for a single favor, and the energy bill, over $115 million from energy companies were donated to Republican politicians that year, that tells you that a lot of favors are being bought in this Congress. And so it's, you know, it's known in Congress that if you want to get something into a bill, you just have to pay for it. And you know, congressmen openly talk about this, and it's a total corruption of the system. You know, and I think it's something that even the congressmen are very depressed about, that they know that they as soon as they get elected, they have to start raising money again, and that's what they have to think about all the time. And I think a lot of the congressmen would like to have publicly financed campaigns or some way of avoiding having to make these decisions.
Matt Taibbi, you covered the Howard Dean campaign. You covered the John Kerry campaign. What do you expect in these midterm elections?
Well, I expect that the Democrats are going to make significant gains. I just got back from Ohio, where I covered the Gene Schmidt, Victoria Wilson campaign. And she is running in a district where the Republicans have held control for all but 10 years of the century. And it's been traditionally a safe district, but it's up for grabs now. And I think actually Wilson is going to win, the Democrat, which tells me that if the Republicans are losing traditionally safe districts, that there's going to be significant defections this time around. But most people expect that these are going to be temporary defections, that it's just anger at the incumbency, and that 2 years from now we're probably going to see a return to a Republican majority. But I think the Democrats are going to win at least the House this time around.
And why would there be that sense that this would be only a temporary swing?
Because I think people are angry at this particular batch of Republicans who are in the Congress right now, but I don't see a significant shift in attitudes toward, you know, against conservative politics in these places. I think they're just angry at this particular group of people. And I also think that there's a lot of people who feel that this particular group of Republicans has betrayed traditional conservative values. And I think what you're going to see in the next 2 years is a new spate of Republicans who are back to sort of traditional fiscal conservatism and away from the hot-button social issues that got a lot of these guys elected.
Matt Taibbi, I want to thank you very much for being with us. The piece that he wrote in the latest issue of Rolling Stone is called "The Worst Congress Ever." Thanks.
Thank you very much.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, gay marriage in New Jersey. We'll speak with a pair of women, one of the seven couples who challenge New Jersey laws. Stay with us.
I can't conceal it, don't you see?
Saba. I do, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. On Wednesday, the Supreme Court of New Jersey ruled gay couples are entitled to the same legal rights as married heterosexuals. The ruling could make New Jersey the second state in the nation to allow gay marriage. Until now, the only state to allow gay marriage was Massachusetts, while Vermont and Connecticut allow civil unions for gay couples. Lawmakers will have 6 months to decide whether state law should allow same-sex couples the right to marriage or the right to civil unions. The ruling was approved by a vote of 4-3. The dissenters say they voted against the ruling because they believe it doesn't go far enough. The three judges say the ruling should have asserted gay couples' fundamental right to marriage rather than leaving it to lawmakers. On November 7th, voters in 8 states will vote on ballot measures limiting gay marriage or unions. We're joined right now by two women. We're joined by Sondra Toby Heath and Alicia Heath Toby. They're one of the 7 gay and lesbian couples who filed the suit in New Jersey. We welcome you both to Democracy
Thank
Now!
Thank you. Good morning.
Your response to the decision?
A mix. It's a mixture of being very happy and being not quite so pleased. I'm the eternal optimist of the two of us, so I did the glasses half full as opposed to half empty. And I was very happy that all of the justices agreed that our rights had been violated. It told me that they did pay attention, that they were listening to our lawyers, that they were reading the briefs, hearing our stories, and maybe during the course of the 4 years where we were out in the public arena, maybe they were watching that too. So I was feeling really good about that, that they were paying attention. The three justices that dissented, I felt like they took it a step further. They opened their heart, you know, and they saw that we're just like anyone else, you know, and we deserve to have equal rights, you know. The other four, I call them a work in progress. Maybe down the road they'll get it fully. But, you know, on the whole, I felt good. I just realized that the fight wasn't over. So the next 6 months, we're going to be fighting probably harder than we fought in the 4 years we've been in this fight to get what we want, which is marriage.
And, Alicia, in terms of your decision to participate in the suit and to wage this campaign, what made you come to that decision and take such an active role in?
My wife made me. My wife received a call, and I call her my wife because we had a ceremony in our home 8 years ago.
Seven years ago.
And she received a call from Lambda requesting an interview with us, and she was very excited, and she called me and said, Lambda is sending someone to talk to us about participating in a lawsuit in New Jersey for the right to marry for same-sex couples. And history was then made. I never questioned it. I never thought of saying no. I never was concerned about exposure. Our lives has always been an open book. I've always been out. I don't know what the inside of a closet looks like. So it was very easy. It was very natural. It was very the right thing to do. And so it never dawned on me to do anything other than what we are doing now.
And amazingly, the dissenting judges who were taking the more liberal position were appointed by Republican governors, whereas
wow.
The ones who took the more conservative position were appointed by Democrats. Were you surprised
wow.
about the,
yes.
the breakdown of the judges?
Well, see, I didn't know that little bit of information. I was just, I don't know if I was surprised at all by it. I didn't know. I had no idea what the decision would be. I didn't. When we left the Supreme Court that day, some months ago, I felt very hopeful. I felt very positive. But as our lawyer, Dave Buckle, said, you know, don't attach a lot of importance to that, how you're feeling, because you can be feeling, like, really uplifted and, like, this is going to happen. And, you know, maybe one of the justices would have a bad night the night before. And you know what I mean? You just, people are human, so you didn't know. I didn't want to get my hopes up too high. So, that's where I was doing this whole thing.
Alicia and Toby, can you tell us how you met? Tell us about your family. Tell us about the time you've been together.
Okay, it's interesting that you say Alicia and Toby. That's my my mom's. We call my mom Toby.
I mean Alicia and Sandy.
Sandra. We met through a mutual friend. I was moving. I'm a New Yorker. And I'm going down as such, but I was moving, and I was moving to New Jersey, and a friend of ours wasn't even introducing us. Sandra happened to be with her at the time, and they visited me to talk about this move into this apartment that our mutual friend was leaving. And when I saw her, I thought, ooh, she's very attractive. And I didn't think anything else of it. And then I moved into the house in which she lived, and she had a space on the second floor, and I was moving to the third floor. And one day she came up, and she gave me this whole inquisition about who are you, where are you from, what does your mom do, like that whole. And from that, we became friends. And it was, I never thought, anything of it, though. We just being friends. It's nice to move into a new town and have somebody who knows the town and somebody that's, And one day I said, wow, I think I love this woman. And we went to dinner and I said to her, I think I love you. And she's sitting across from me and she literally looks at me like I'm a blank sheet of paper. And I go, okay, I think I might have said too much. And we just kept eating. It was almost like suspended in midair kind of thing. And, we continued to just have a relationship and a friendship. And then on January 1st, we decided that we would be a couple. And this January, we would have been together 18 years. And it has been
quite an adventure.
You're a pastor, you're a reverend?
Yes, I'm a reverend. I'm the assistant pastor at Liberation and Truth Unity Fellowship Church in Newark, New Jersey. And she's my first lady.
Tell us about your last names.
When we joined our lives, we because it's not legal in New Jersey, we wanted to honor each other. And my maiden name is Toby. And so we wanted to keep our last names at the end just for legal purposes so that we wouldn't have a whole bunch of questions. And so we decided to, by honoring each other, take each other's names, but leaving our surnames at the end.
And so yours is?
So my surname is Alicia. I was born Toby. And so I took Heath, so I put Heath before my last, and she did the flip.
And now, of course, the court has put all of this in the hands of the legislature to finally, the state legislature to finally iron out how they will sanction unions. What do you do now in terms of from here on in?
Well, we work. We get out there and we advocate. We become a tick on the behinds of the legislators. We get in their ear and just annoy them. Like I was telling my wife, this 6 months is probably going to, we're probably going to work harder than we have the four years, 4 months in this lawsuit, as far as just, you know, we just have that window of 178 days now, you know, so my feeling is that we got to work, find out, the politicians that support us, the ones who are against us, and just, sign petitions, send, just a mass flood of information. And like my wife was speaking at the rally on Wednesday in Montclair, and she challenged the audience to become involved. It's not just about the plaintiff couples,
One of the things that I'm most encouraged by, that it's now not just about 6.5 couples. Because, as we know, we lost one of the women. She passed away. So it's not about the 6.5 of us anymore. It is about the public, the people. And that in and of itself is the most empowering thing about this whole thing. So do I believe in, things happen? No, I believe that things happen for a reason. That there are no mistakes, and that this is an issue that impacts the people. And so now it is the people's responsibility that really believe in the right thing, which is marriage, that they will get behind this thing, and then they will get in the trenches, and that they will get their hands dirty, and that they will do the work. Because it really impacts the people. That is why we chose to do it, that it's bigger than Sandra and I, that it's about the rights of other people who identify and love the same ways in which we do. And now it's their responsibility to get behind this thing. And if you really believe that you deserve to be married and that be called marriage, then you will be compassionate and compelled and passionate about doing it.
Your kids, their response?
Our children,
we have
two sons, her sons, and we have six grandchildren, actually one on the way.
Yeah.
And, of course, they had mixed feelings.
Yes.
First of all, they had mixed feelings about our relationship. But we have, we've been together so long, and we've been loving each other and doing the same things that they do as heterosexual men. And when we decided to do this, I'm sure that they had some feelings around us being exposed and possibly being exposed. But we were very sensitive that we didn't want to expose them in any way that they didn't want to be exposed. And I must say, if you ask either one of them, and even some of our grandbabies who could speak, they would say that we're doing the right thing, that it's important, that it's about doing something for the bigger picture and beyond today. And they would say that their grandparents are activists, and that they will stand up when no one else will. And that in of itself, my wife said the other day that she saves all of the stuff. I mean, she just has all these papers, newspapers. And she said, one day we will sit with our grandchildren and we will tell the stories, and they will hear them, and they will know that they come from greatness. And that is so much greater than the moment.
Well, Alicia Heath Toby and Sandra Toby Heath, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute.
Thank you.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. A leading Israeli human rights organization accused Israel Thursday of breaking international humanitarian law by holding thousands of Palestinian prisoners in Israel. According to B'Tselem, international law prohibits the transfer of civilians, including prisoners, from the occupied territories to Israel. On Thursday, B'Tselem issued a 53-page report outlining how Israel's prison policies made it nearly impossible for Palestinians to regularly visit relatives in jail. Meanwhile, a former Israeli soldier named Yehuda Shaul has just begun a tour of the U.S. to give an inside look at how the Israeli military treats Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. Shaul is a co-founder of Breaking the Silence, a group of former Israeli soldiers committed to exposing human rights abuses by the Israeli military.
Last year, the group revealed that Israeli soldiers had been ordered to open fire on unarmed Palestinians. The group has also gathered photographic evidence that proved Israeli soldiers have abused Palestinian corpses. Yehuda Shaul joins us now from San Francisco. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Welcome. Good morning.
Could you talk to us a little bit about what you're hoping to accomplish on your tour?
I'm here in the United States because I would say we in Breaking the Silence see the act of breaking the silence as an act of taking responsibility. As ex-Israeli soldiers who served as combat soldiers in the occupied territories and were there and committed all what we're talking about, were part of the occupation, after we were discharged and realized what we were doing and what was going on around us, there was only two options, as I see it. There was or to lock ourselves in the room, cry and ask forgiveness, or to stand up and take responsibility and demand from others to take responsibility. So in my eyes, breaking the silence, standing up and telling the stories and trying to bring people to know and to realize and to understand what it means, occupation, on a daily basis, through these testimonies that we publish and the pictures that we had in your exhibition, is demanding from Israeli society to take responsibility for it, for what is being done in their behalf. And in my eyes, in our eyes, responsibility doesn't end with ex-soldiers who served there or with Israelis, who the IDF, our army as Israelis, is doing all these things. Responsibility is to every human being in the world, and for sure for Americans. Because in the end of the day, for all what Israel does, there is only one country in the world that, you know, the chief of staff and the Prime Minister of Israel has to report in the end of the day, and that's the United States of America. For that reason, I think that people of America must know what's going on there and must break their own silence and take civil responsibility, human responsibility, to what is being done there.
Yehuda Shaul, tell us your story. How did you end up in the military? How did you decide to leave?
In Israel, every Jewish Israeli is obligated by law to serve in the military. Men for 3 years, women for 2 years. And when I reached the age of 18, I was drafted for 3 years. I served as a combat soldier and a commander. Two years out of my 3 years were in the occupied territories, and 14 months were in Hebron. And during my service in the occupied territories, I just did whatever I would, you know, I had to do, whatever were my missions, fulfilling my missions, leading my soldiers, doing all sorts of things, what it means, occupation. And suddenly, like 3 months before I was discharged, I was sitting down and trying to imagine myself as a civilian. I told myself, you know, in 3 months, I'm going to give back my weapon, my uniform, stop being a combat soldier, and again, going back to civilian life. And for me, that same moment, you know, the exact moment of stop thinking as a professional combat soldier was a moment of, maybe I can call it an enlightenment, you know. It's a moment of stop seeing things through the eyes of a soldier and start seeing things through an eye of a civilian. It's like, again, stop seeing things from in the system and start observing it from outside. And when I suddenly looked at myself from the outside and looked backwards, you know, to what I've done in the past 2 years and 10 months in the occupied territories as a soldier, I was totally shocked. I realized that something mad was going around me. Suddenly I realized that the situation that I took part in brought me to do stuff that, you know, I wanted to believe that it wasn't me, but, you know, I couldn't escape it. It was me. And when I realized that, I felt that I can't continue my life without doing something about it. And that's when I started to speak with some of my soldiers, some of my comrades, and I discovered that we all felt the same, but we didn't have the courage to speak about it. You know, it was something that we didn't, it was somewhere in the back of the mind, but we didn't open it inside the unit. And because we all felt the same, we all felt that something wrong is going around us, we decided to break the silence. And I was discharged in March 2004. In June 2004, we started our activities with a photo exhibition and video testimonies from our service in Hebron. As I said, I served 14 months in Hebron, so it was obvious that we're going to start from there. And the idea of the exhibition, we called it then, is to break the silence surrounding what's going on in the occupied territories and what we called bringing Hebron to Tel Aviv. Because you must understand that, you know, what's going on in the occupied territories is like the biggest secret in Israeli society. It's like the taboo. You never talk about it. It's like something that happens in the backyard. It's the dirt from the backyard that no one wants to have it in the front. And for that reason,
I'd like to ask you about all of these thousands of Palestinian prisoners. If from your perspective, as someone who's obviously had to participate in the capturing and imprisonment of some of these of these Palestinian civilians, what is this doing to Palestinian society to have so many people locked up for such a long period of time under Israeli control?
I have no idea. I'm not a Palestinian. Just, you know, looking from the outside seems like breaking all the family structure. I don't know, just trying to think of, you know, all the people that we arrested, bumping in the middle of the night through the windows, through the doors, through the roofs, waking up the family, taking people. No one knows when they're going to get back, why they were taken. You know, this is just, you know, every night, almost every night in the occupied territories, you do an arrest operation. Every night you come back with what we saw in the pictures before, what you see now of handcuffed, blindfold Palestinians who are just, you know, we're now arrested, waiting to be taken to interrogations at the secret services. But also, there's another kind of Palestinians, as you see now in the picture. And that's kind of what we call in Hebrew, or I will translate it, what we call dry outs. Or if I would professionally translate, it's detainees. And these are Palestinians, you know, when you stand in the checkpoint and you ask from all the Palestinians to stand in a very nice one line, and suddenly one of them starts screaming or leaves the line, so you must educate him, right? They must know who is the boss. So you detain him at his side. You took him handcuffed, blindfold, 5, 6, 7 hours. It could be more, it can be less. Or you call a Palestinian in a checkpoint. You ask for him his ID. He smiles too much. You must educate him. And all the system is built on fear. It's built of just oppressing, I don't know, of not being able to treat Palestinians as equal human beings to you, because the job is to do things that you don't do to equal human beings. You know, to bump in the middle of the night to a family from the roof and wake up all the family, separate men from women, and just search all the house. It's something that you don't do to an equal human being to you. It's something that I never done in Israel. But in the occupied territories, as a combat soldier, as an occupier, that's my daily job, 24/7, house after an house.
Yehuda Shaul, we have to leave it there, but we will link to Breaking the Silence and your tour where you'll be in this country as we speak to him today in San Francisco. That does it for today's broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Adokudus, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Aaron Mate, Jen Yudes, Mike DeFilippo, and Nick Marsilio are our engineers. Tonight I'll be in Olympia, Washington, tomorrow in Mount Vernon and Bellingham, and at night in Vancouver, Canada, on Sunday in Victoria, Canada. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.